kids, Bat Segundo here, and I'm feeling a bit disappointed by this author, or alleged author, Kelly Link. You see, when one picks up a book called Magic for Beginners, one expects to learn how to pull a rabbit out of a hat, or at least a few cheap card tricks that one can use to impress friends. But not a single magic act along these lines could be found within this book's pages. Thus, the book is fundamentally worthless. I've written to Harcourt to demand my money back. They've stifled my boyhood dreams of becoming a magician. They are blackguards of the First Order. But apparently, our young loving correspondent didn't find this to be the case at all. I'm beginning to suspect that he cannot be trusted.
So I am here with the one, the only, Kelly Link, who is the author of Magic for Beginners, Stranger Things Happen, as well as a number of other, I'm sure, three-word title books.
Not yet, but soon.
Yeah. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm good.
Okay. And are you becoming sufficiently awake because of the coffee?
Or? The coffee is beginning to kick in.
Yeah, you were telling me that apparently you didn't start drinking coffee until you were 25.
Until I was 25, and at which point I realized that coffee was a drug.
Yeah.
And some drugs are really good.
Now, your stories are very interesting because they often require a lot of faith on the part of the reader, in the sense that, you know, the reader is kind of being strung along, not knowing exactly what they're getting into. Like, for example, the Hortlock. You don't actually figure out the precise purpose of the store or the relationship between Batu, Eric, and Charlie until sort of the very end. And even then, you don't quite know what it's about. I'm wondering what steps you take to plant these little clues, such as like the Turkish language and all that stuff. Do these come upon you as you sort of redraft your stories, or do you kind of envision a story in one great big gulp, beginning, middle, and end? Or
actually, what I think of my stories is not so much requiring a lot of faith, but requiring a lot of work.
Yeah.
On the part of the reader, some more than others. That story, I wrote a very small section of it as a 20-minute story for McSweeney's project. And the McSweeney's anthology actually came out. I'm in the contributor's notes, but somehow my stories got left out.
Wait a minute. We're going to have to go down to 826 Valencia right now and sort this out.
Yeah, I'm going to go bang on their door. They don't open until noon. But,
oh, okay.
That was a while ago. But so I had this very short, mostly self-contained piece that I'd written in 20 minutes, really liked it, and then I waited about a year or so until I had more stuff to sort of stick into it. It's a process of accretion. You know, once I started thinking, I know a guy named Batu, he's a friend of a friend, thought it was a great name, he was a lot of fun to hang out with, the character's not like him, and yet somehow hanging out with this friend of a friend made me think, all right, I'd like to write a story with a guy named Batu in it.
Yeah, so that was the inspiration for this.
It was. Actually, I have a lot of friends who speak Turkish. After the first edition came out, I'd run it by one, and then after the edition came out, they said, actually, some of this is not so great. And I'd been using all these different guidebooks. So there are some, hopefully in the paperback edition, the Turkish is slightly closer to the actual Turkish.
So a story for you then is basically sort of a process of like accumulating details.
Accretion.
Accretion was the word you used. But I guess these stories kind of go through different forms, and some of the forms we see, in, for example, this 20-minute form, and then some of them, you know, because I also know that you've mentioned in previous interviews that you'd hope a few of these stories in here would actually sort of kind of explode into a novel form or form the backbone. Maybe you could describe this a little bit, you know, in terms of like, I guess it seems to be very much like this great sort of snowball that kind of collects details.
You know, when I first started writing, I would think that I had enough ideas for four or five stories, and when I started to write, they would all end up in the same story. And I began to feel as if I, in fact, could not write until I had three or four or five or six stories bouncing around in the back of my head. And other stories are very fast. You know, it almost feels as if the more inside a character's voice you are, the easier it is to... Thank you. The easier it is to tell a very streamlined, simple story. If you're deep inside a character's head, they're focused on particular things. The farther outside the character's point of view you are, the more extra stuff you're noticing. But at the same time, the less you know about how the character all the stories that that character is involved in. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. Yeah. I'm wondering if in the process of accretion, whether you need some sort of gestation period, because you often, like, well, you definitely certainly see something after, like, 6 months where, you know, all of a sudden all these details become completely clear. Whether you sort of need this to kind of keep these stories kind of building or growing into these great sorts of forms, you know, I don't know.
Yes, and a lot of the process is mysterious to me. Sometimes I'm on a good streak and stories will come very quickly and they will seem to be different kinds of stories. Right now, writing is pretty tricky. Stories are getting really, really long, but I don't like them as much as the shorter stories, so I'm actually getting quite nervous about the idea of writing a novel. I feel as if I sit down to write a novel, perhaps I will forget how to do the shorter stories. And so actually my goal over the next couple of months is to write a very, very short story.
But simultaneously, though, a novel will allow you to kind of just explore even more variations on a particular theme, like, you know, like zombies, which is a great theme in this, you know. You can go into considerably more sort of nuances and sort of explore it in a kind of really kind of concentrated level that you can't necessarily do in a short story.
Well, it's a question of, you know, what do you like better, putting stuff in or leaving stuff out?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been writing stories that are 20,000, 30,000 words long for the last year, and right now what I really want to do is leave stuff out. And even in novels, a writer is choosing what they leave out, what sort of work they want the reader to do. But I don't feel as if I feel like I'm carrying a lot of baggage when I sit down to sort of tackle something at longer length.
You're not really a fan of the sort of kitchen sink approach to...
I am a fan of it, but it turns out that I don't think I'm very good at it necessarily. I'm good at it in small doses. To an extent, that makes me happy, but at longer length, I start becoming really bored with my own work. So we'll see.
So essentially, it's what I'm getting at here is that it's basically a sense of just like keeping yourself sort of sustained and keeping yourself sort of thrown off guard as you write these stories.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, this actually ties in rather nicely into a question I was going to ask you, and that was I was reading an interview that you did with Stephanie Allenbach over at Maude Newton's site, and you know, you had noted in that interview that you were actually easily distracted, and I wanted to talk to you about this because I was talking with Mary Gateskill the other day, and she also pointed out to me that she needed a 15 to 1 hour period to really sort of sit down and kind of channel her energies because she was easily distracted, and yet both your work and her work are really sort of very focused, very sustained. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's any sort of advantages, particularly like in fantasy, to sort of having these distractions or to being distracted, whether distractions kind of in their own way perhaps allow you to focus in this particular way. Maybe you can comment
on that. I think that being easily distracted mirrors or is the same thing in some ways as noticing connections too easily. And that does mean that once you have once you're solidly at work on a story, everything that you see around you, you can sort of pull in and use. Everything in the story, you can sort of tie down to other parts of the story. And I think that quality has something in common. That desire to do that has something that's connected to being easily distracted. You know, I don't even know how to describe it. You know, it's not even a sense that everything is connected to everything else, but everything can be used to talk about everything else.
Yeah. I was averring from your last answer that, you know, you needed to be thrown off guard. Maybe this kind of ties into the distraction element, you know?
You know, I think it has a lot to do with sort of the pattern-making impulse.
Yeah.
And seeing things that don't fit into the pattern and then needing to sort of step aside and see how you can fit them into the pattern or how the pattern changes.
Do you find that you sort of stumble upon these patterns through kind of observation, then rumination, and then you need sort of this, again, I'm going back to this notion of a gestation period, but I wanted to sort of ask you if how much do you discover through the act of writing versus the act of actually thinking about a story and figuring out its plot?
I discover a great deal when I write, but conversation is part of that. A sense of discomfort or itchiness is part of the process. I have not really wanted to write much for the last couple of months because I've been traveling so much.
Yeah.
And I had 3 weeks at home recently, and I just got to the point where I was thinking, I really would like to write something now, and then I took off again.
So this is of course like a large absence that prevents you from getting involved with a routine, but I'm guessing though, I guess the question I'm trying to get at here is just like, to what extent does my papers fly all over the place?
Sound effects of papers flying.
How much do you really truly need to be sort of thinking about something in order to be sort of thrown off guard so that your interest in a short story is actually sort of sustained?
I think I do have to have both of those things. I have to be pretty deeply focused on what I think this will go into the story, and then I need at certain points to be distracted and to have sort of new stuff filter in ways that throw me off guard. Because otherwise, the story would be under such tight control that it would perhaps not be very lively.
I actually wanted to ask you about something that probably nobody has asked you, but the Douglas Adams references in this. The end of the fairy handbag actually has a very explicit sort of Scrabble-based homage to Douglas Adams, as well as the explicit reference of the Vogons in the Magic for Beginners. Now, this struck me as actually quite interesting. It sort of, you know, demonstrates that, well, you know, I think you're a literary writer, but at the same time, there's these very sort of, I guess, populist science fiction kinds of influences for yours. Maybe you could talk about how important someone like Adams is towards, you know, presenting these particular stories. Or,
you know, I have not gone back to reread Douglas Adams in a long time. I've been rereading Terry Pratchett, whom I also love. And I think of myself very strongly. I feel that I'm a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
It's the stuff that I grew up reading. I continue to read it. I co-edit the fantasy half of the year's Best Fantasy and Horror.
Yeah.
So I'm about as deep into genre as you can get. But, you know, it's not, there's no science in it. But there, the references to other work is pretty pleasurable.
Yeah.
The crossword reference is also, friends of mine had been living together for a long time, and she came home one day and he had proposed to her using the Scrabble board, and I just thought that was such a great means of communication.
Yeah.
And there the idea of using board games as a sort of predictive setups, I kind of like the idea of using pretty commonplace things to sort of as prognostication tools.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely. I mean, sometimes we don't actually see enough of board games, I think, in fiction. And I'm a bit of a board game junkie, in
all
fact.
Right.
So when you do something like this, it's sort of like, oh, well, we get to see this kind of part of the world that is not often explored. And often, not only that, you get to sort of take, I'm now rambling again, something like board games, or something also like very specific sort of food cultural references in your work, too. In that same story, you have a Cadbury cream egg. There's also a reference to, in Stone Animals, the wall smelling like Fruit Loops. Do you think that these kinds of cultural sort of reference points like this, that are so common, are these entry points, perhaps, for people who are not as genre blind as us?
Maybe. I actually had not thought about that, but there are probably enough touchstones that it does make work easier.
Yeah.
On the other hand, everybody at this point has some sort of backing, whether they think about it or not, in science fiction because of movies or television shows or things like that. The, you know, the Fruit Loops and the Cadbury cream eggs, these are very childhood specific things. I could not possibly eat a Cadbury cream egg. No, I think it would kill me. And Fruit Loops, I do not usually go near.
Yeah.
And yet the my sense memory of Fruit Loops is very strong, very loaded.
Yeah.
It's a very pleasurable thought when I think of Fruit Loops.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I know. That's a good point. For Frosted Flakes, I couldn't possibly eat that. No, but I mean, actually, this also ties into the whole board game thing, because that also is very much a childhood reference point.
Sure.
Do these kinds of child reference points allow you to maintain a sense of play when you write these stories? Is that what this is all about?
Yes, and I think there's the same thing about board games that we were talking about earlier, where there's that aspect of control, and there's also that aspect of chance or surprise, that there's a sense that there's a pattern to something, that there's a strategy, but there are also things along the way that are you're not going to sort of be expecting when you sit down to play.
Yeah. In what sense are your short stories very similar to sort of board games and having a sort of predetermined pattern? I mean, obviously, there's loads of ambiguity in a lot of these stories, particularly the Hortlock, which we had just mentioned.
Mm.
Do you sometimes feel dissatisfied when you finish a story because it's not entirely sort of, okay, it has a natural end, okay, but at the same time, there's still all of these, you know, oodles of ambiguity here.
I was actually about to say that I'm fairly sure for some readers, my ends are about as unsatisfying as the end of a board game usually is. You know, in German board games like Catan or Transcontinental, there's the pleasure is in the middle when you're sort of building these cities or when you're building your railroad line and then suddenly somebody wins and the game is over and you sort of think, oh.
The game of life really is anticlimactic. Yes. You know, the whole, you're at the retirement home at the end.
Yes, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Yeah.
With your friends.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's the same thing. You hear snippets of other people's stories and you don't necessarily find out the conclusions or resolutions. You frequently read newspaper stories and it'll be nice to know what happened to the people, you know, in the stories. What, but you don't.
Yeah.
And even that is sort of satisfying because what it tells you is that the world exists outside yourself and that stuff goes on even when you're not aware of it.
There's one thing I've observed in your stories that I find interesting is that you don't really dwell so much on backstory compared to a lot of other writers. You depict these characters' struggles in the present, which I find very interesting because particularly a lot of emerging short story writers feel the need to, like, you know, load all this back end in their stuff. I mean, was this something that you weaned out of yourself early on, or...?
I don't know, actually. I've never thought about that. I mean, the thing that I like best about working at the short length is how much you can leave out, how much you can imply by sentences that are actually doing other work at the time, you know, by even the language that you have a character use to describe something tells you something in a very unexplicit way, in a very sort of shadowy way about the characters using that language. And so you get all those other tools to use. You know, it's compressed, there's things missing, and the reader can sort of choose to fill in whatever it is that they need to know about a character if you're doing the right things and if the reader is on the same wavelength that you are.
Well, I mean, do you feel that backstory along these lines is kind of, does it weaken or hinder a story? I mean, we're talking about this kind of like removing excess baggage notion.
I think it can probably be done very beautifully. I like working at a certain speed, which means, and this is the problem with the sort of longer stories I'm doing now, is it is much harder for me to tell what's essential, what I can leave out. It feels as if I'm learning how to rewrite in a very different style, and maybe I should start thinking about the backstory that I've probably been sticking into these newer pieces.
Well, but I would also argue these newer pieces actually, I mean, I'd actually like to make an interesting comparison with Richard Yates, because there's a more concern for that type of sort of behavior. Particularly in Stone Animals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that appeared also in Conjunctions as well.
Mm-hmm.
This to me was quite interesting, an interesting development from the stories in the previous volume, because, and it also kind of creates a story that is truly sort of cross-genre and totally unpinpointable, unidentifiable.
Oh, good.
And then you can kind of just sort of, you know, flip the bird at all the people. Oh, yes, Kelly Lake is one of those speculative fiction writers. You know? Are these sorts of observed behavior something you've been consciously trying to put into your work to sort of get rid of these silly genre definitions?
No, but I was trying to write a different kind of story. You know, the thing about writing is if you continue to work in the same vein, the vein gets tapped, it bleeds out, it gets tapped out, whatever, however you want to put it.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to try different stylistic techniques, a different kind of narrator. I wanted to be able to move in and out of characters' points of views very quickly. And that story also took about a year to write, as opposed to other stories that some stories take, you know, 2 or 3 days. The Fairy Handbag took 2 days.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
But I was up against a deadline, which is sometimes a very useful technique.
Yeah.
For pushing things to a good place.
So constraints are very good for you, though.
Constraints are good. On the other hand, it used to be that if I had a deadline coming up that I could knuckle down and get the work done, and I've relied on that for a number of years, and now I have so much other kind of work that, in fact, the deadline trick no longer works. I have to go out and find a different way to make myself sit down and do work.
Sure, sure. Actually, I wanted to go back to the zombies. We were talking about them earlier, and I had hoped to talk about them at length with you, because we have three stories. We've got Lull, the Hortlock, and, of course, some zombie contingency plans. And they all concern themselves with zombie. Now, I mean, I'm also a zombie fan.
But, who is not?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, there was something I was going to mention. Roger Ebert once described zombies as all they can do is shuffle, moan, catch up with much faster people, and chew on their arms. This was in a Shaun of the Dead review. But I actually wanted to point out the zombies in these three stories are kind of very much in the background. Do you think that, that you know, putting them in the background as opposed to the foreground is the only real way to deal with zombies, or have we not really dealt with them enough? I mean, have we not really sort of explored their full...
the full range of zombie? Yeah. I don't think we've explored the whole range of zombie possibilities yet. In the Hortlock, in some zombie contingency plans, the zombies are much more like wallpaper or the shadowy stuff that's out of focus when you're watching a movie, or like those little ducks that go by when you're trying to shoot at things. You know, they're just sort of coming through on a regular basis or a repeating pattern. And partly that's because the traditional kind of movie zombie, it's not really something I want to write about. I'm not really into the brain chewing. I am in the movies. I like it in the movies, but in print, not so much.
Well, the other thing that's interesting about your use of zombies is that they're also kind of like, almost in some sense, we can interpret this way, as like psychological manifestations of the characters. Zombies kind of serve almost as reference points for the way that these sorts of misfit characters kind of view the universe.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you want to jump off that point?
I don't. I feel as if I'm being asked to analyze my own stories in a way that... Okay. My father was a psychologist, and so I will send him my stories, he will read them, and then he'll call me up on the phone, and he'll say, so, you know, in this story, what's going on behind this? And I really don't want to go there.
Oh, my God.
He's a good guy.
I wonder if other writers are like this with psychologists as parents.
Probably, yes. Yeah. It worries him when he can't see can't fit it into a sort of analytic pattern. Yeah. And so possibly some of my stories are attempts to confound my father. You know, I've workshopped fiction for a long time, and I think there's something useful about workshop in that you hear lots of different things, lots of different people telling you what your stories are about, and you can either decide to push particular readings. You can think, yeah, that reading's kind of nice. Or you can decide, I like all of those readings. Or you can think, I don't want anybody to have a sort of solid take on this. And so you can sort of tailor your later drafts to, you've gotten feedback. You know what the effect was in the earlier draft. And you think, I'll subvert that a little bit, or I'll push it a bit, or I'll fuck them all. You know, I will make this as hard as I can for anybody to stand on.
I guess it seems that you
I say that with love.
Yeah. Oh no. I get that. I mean, well, like for example, the title story in this Magic for Beginners is probably the most intricate story in the collection, in the sense that you have just loaded. You've got television within television within television for God's sake. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wondering if, I guess, based off of what we're sort of describing here in terms of like complexity versus just sort of, I guess, a simple story. What made Magic for Beginners in particular this kind of story in which you just had to unload so many different kinds of elements? You know, as dramatic as that, you know.
That wasn't me. I didn't do that.
Yeah. It wasn't a sound effect either. But no, anyway.
That was the sound of the many pieces of story. That story has a lot of stuff crammed into it, and I would not have said this at the time. I think it was sort of in the back of my head. I wanted to do all the things in a story about television that you could not actually do on a television show, including have TV inside TV inside TV, to do all the things that on a real television show would require such an enormous budget that nobody would do it. And so I piled a lot of stuff in.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty tangled story. It's a story with a lot of loose ends. And my hope really was that people who like fanfic might sort of take it as a jumping off point, because this is in some ways a homage to Buffy. You know, if I wrote fanfic, if I had been at the right age when I was watching Buffy, and if I had been more aware of fanfiction community, maybe I would have written Buffy fanfic. But you know, this is sort of my version of it. But I wanted to leave space for people to do other stuff with it.
Well, the interesting thing about the library is that it actually reminded me more of, in pattern recognition, the sort of strips of film, or even like House of Leaves, the sort of like endless kind of, you know, hypothetically in another story or in a launching off point, people would be dissecting the library as ardently as all of the academics in Dan Lowski's book.
I really like pattern recognition. I was not aware that I was sort of riffing near the same territory or off the off Gibson until after I finished, and Gavin said, you know, this is kind of like the I thought, oh shit. But everybody you know, bounces off everybody else. There's you know, everybody is engaged in the same sort of business, reading the same kind of work. And books about books, you know, mysteries in which there's a book that must be found, or a secret history, or a small locked, you know, box which contains something. These are sort of the things that I like best in fiction.
The other thing about that story that I found amusing is that the common sort of motif, we have endless books written with writers. You have a writer in this book about television, you know, which I found that to be kind of the interesting sort of
response. I hadn't thought about that. Now that you pointed out, I'm really pleased with myself. Thank you.
And on top of that, a penny-pinching writer to boot. You know. Was this a cognizant part on your end in terms of throwing a writer into this? Or?
I lived in Boston. We used to drive around Boston, go to bookstores. So we went to a bookstore up on the Cape years ago. And Edward Gorey, I guess, had recently died. But in this bookstore, they just had piles of signed Gorey books, and we said to the woman who worked there, "You guys are really lucky to have all this," because we were working in a bookstore at the time, and it was amazing. It was this treasure trove, and she looked really kind of mildly bitter. She's like, "Yeah, we had this arrangement. He could come in and shoplift anything he wanted as long as he always signed his books for us," and that stuck with me for 10 years. I thought about that. That was just such a, it's that thing where if you are good enough, if you're well-known enough, if you're talented enough, you are sort of, you take liberties. People do it all the time. And it's a very uncomfortable dynamic. And the character, the father, the writer, he's not a bad guy. He's not a good guy either. He's a good guy in some ways, a bad guy in other ways. But I really based him on this bookstore on the Cape, and the sort of the way that the bookstore clerk clearly like had mixed feelings about the trade that they'd had.
Yeah. Well, you also started off working in bookstores and then kind of emerged. It's quite a trajectory in terms of essentially self-publishing the book, and then all of a sudden seeing this thing take off, and now Harcourt has put this out. It's really sort of an interesting sort of trajectory that you don't really see with a lot of writers. And it's also very unusual in the sense because you somehow managed to do this without ever kind of appearing to fall into the cataclysm of vanity presses. I mean, what is this a sort of legitimate sort of path for a writer, or if they're good enough?
I don't know. You know, a lot of things happened at the same time, which made it much more easy for Stranger Things Happen to work as a book and get reviewed and get into bookstores. It was frankly not what I was expecting. Most of the stories have been published in magazines, mostly in genre magazines. And we figured that we would sell a certain number of copies, that we would break even. We did another book at the same time, and we wanted to do books, and we were sort of testing the water in some ways. And also, it just seemed to me that probably nobody would ever want to publish a short story collection that I had written, or it would take so long that I would have several collections ready by that point, and I really wanted to make a book. And when I was in late high school and then in college, I bought the Ellen Datlow and Terry Wendling Years Past Fantasy and Horror, and I would pour through that, the introduction, so I could figure out which books I wanted to go try and track down, because they both recommended books. And then I would read through the anthology to see, because I love short stories, which short story writers I should be looking for stuff by. And Gavin and I do that book now. You know, we took over from Terry Wendling.
Yeah.
And so there are still, and this year there are many, many, many sort of year's best anthologies. And not all of them are in genre and fantasy and science fiction. There's mystery, there's erotica, there's all sorts of, there's the non-required reading. And I still dip into anthologies of reprint work in order to find people that I would like to find more work by, especially short stories. I just read a collection, it's called Brief Encounters with Che Guevara.
I've heard of this.
It's really good.
It
it's really, really good. So it's. I still pick up collections, but book buying is an expensive habit.
I know.
And there's something nice about reprint anthologies and original anthologies, because it's like a candy box. You're getting all these different people, and you're not going to like all of them.
But like in terms of, for example, review coverage, for example, if you are a short story writer working in a genre, you've got two strikes against you, because they're only going to consider, for the most part, novels.
Mm-hmm.
And they thumb their noses up at genre, and they don't look at it for its own sort of credibility. I mean, you know, what is the state of like sort of a genre short story? I mean, what do we do to sort of get literary credibility? I mean, there's some street cred obviously for it, but you know.
I'm actually deeply uncomfortable with the idea of literary credibility.
Yeah,
and there are so many kinds of books which I really enjoy reading, which it's very easy to say, that might be fun, but it's not really good. I feel that way about young adult.
Yeah.
There are romance novels, which may not be sort of... romance is sort of trickiest of all, I feel, the genre. There are so many rules about how the book is supposed to work that I think it's hard to pull off something really inventive that really stands on its own, that you don't need to have an appreciation for the genre for to really like. But there are mysteries. You know, you can look at most of my favorite books can sort of fit into very specific genres, and so in a sense I'm actually much more comfortable being pigeonholed in some way, or being, you know, if somebody says, oh well, that's science fiction, no, that's not really important, you have much more freedom to sort of go about and do the thing that you're interested in doing. Having said that, you know, I can't really complain with the fact that my books are not always shelved in genre, that I do get reviews. You know, I can't actually sit here and say all of this, because in fact, you know, I got my cake and I ate it.
Yeah.
But I that's why I say I'm a science fiction writer, because you know, I don't actually
Even
like
you're
the
a fantasy writer though.
Exactly. Let's confuse the categories a little bit more.
I will call you a literary writer. How about that? Yeah.
A literary writer is such a bogus term. You know, what does literary mean? I am.
That's true.
You know, there's popular fiction. There is mainstream fiction. There is experimental fiction. There are different kinds of experimental fiction. There are genres, but I. Of all the categories, literary fiction to me seems like the deadliest.
Why is that?
It sounds like something that ought to be very good for you, and which, in all probability, is tedious. And so, when there are books that sort of fall into literary fiction that I really love, I love Jane Hamilton's Disobedience. I would never demean it by calling it literary fiction. I would just say this is a book I really love.
Yeah.
I'd say it's a book.
But is it possible that we could sort of abscond with the term literary fiction and sort of like say, well, literary is actually something like a populist book, like Scott Smith's The Ruins, which, okay.
Sure.
You know,
Which was not, awesome.
I liked it too. I mean, it was the
I was captivated.
It was crack cocaine. My God.
I spent my birthday lying on a couch reading The Ruins, and I was so happy.
Yeah. I know. And, but that is just as much a skill.
Sure.
And one might argue a literary skill as, say, sure. Pontificating about the flora and fauna,
On some days, I may want to read The Ruins. On other days, I may want to read Disobedience. I may want to read the Decameron, Literary fiction is, I think, a very bad term. It's a term that puts people off. I actually think literary fiction puts off more people than saying science fiction does. Or at least literary fiction puts off the readers that I would actually want to attract. Whereas when I say that I write science fiction and someone sort of says, oh, I think, well, probably not the reader I wanted anyway.
I got you. No, but I mean, doesn't it mean in terms of like, I don't know, my attitude is, I'm a bit of an optimist, but my attitude would be that, like Laura Miller, for example, was a huge champion of you. And raved about you in Salon.
Yes.
And that sort of represents to me, it's like, oh, wow, the gates are sort of opening. Okay,
yes.
She still doesn't understand Lovecraft, but,
And my husband, much as I love him, does not understand Lovecraft.
Wow.
It's a mixed marriage.
We're gonna have to do something about that.
And one of my favorite books in the world is Cruddy by Linda Barry. How would you describe that? Would you say that it's literary fiction?
Well, it depends. I mean, it depends on what mood
I wouldn't want to. I feel that it's, so much better than that.
You actually have taxonomies in stone animals.
Mm.
I mean, with the paint chips. So I think taxonomies are a sort of helpful reference point, unless, of course, you're using the taxonomies of the paint to sort of take the piss out of people who categorize
things. Sure. And I actually would like taxonomies a lot more if it were easier to acknowledge that they are extremely inaccurate. And so that's why I like saying science fiction, because I don't actually write science fiction, but it's the roots that I, it's the stuff that I grew up reading. It's in my DNA as a writer. And so even though there's no science in my fiction, I can still say I'm a science fiction writer because I came out of it.
Mm. Okay. Fair enough.
Right. I won't have to beat you up then.
No. I wanted to ask, and I couldn't find an answer to this, but how did Shelley Jackson get involved with the illustrations?
Shelley and I met through a mutual friend, and we lived in the same house in Boston for a little bit more than half a year. She was teaching at MIT, and I started reading her stuff, she read my stuff. I really liked her art. She was doing picture book art. And so when we were first thinking about covers, I asked her if she would be willing to do the cover art. And I wanted something really specific. I wanted a pulp style cover.
Yeah.
And so she really got into it. She got her sister to pose, sort of standing there in high heels with a flashlight.
Oh, nice.
And did various photographs and also sort of worked in sort of the way a traditional pulp artist would have put that together, and I was just ecstatic with it. And so she did this cover as well. She did all the illustrations. I'm actually taking part in her tattoo project.
Oh, really?
Which you know about? Or
no, I don't.
She's project has been going on for like 2 years, but I think she has all her words now.
Oh,
Okay,
so how?
Only
wait
ever
a
be
sec.
Published in tattoos.
Same Shelley Jackson, okay.
Yes, same.
Wow, I had
they're
no,
all the same Shelley Jackson.
Wow. No, I totally know about that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Well, I mean, the illustrations, are they sort of endemic of the, the science fiction that we were talking about of you growing up, or were they just sort
they're
of
actually,
like...
actually, there were children's books that I loved that had Artizoni drawings. There were great drawings, for Joan Aiken's books, Pat Marriott, I think, did those illustrations. I'm really fond of book illustrations. And since we were publishing the hardcover ourselves, I thought, I can do anything I want. I can have illustrations for the stories, which would probably not have been the case if I'd published somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, would you, when Harcourt actually reprinted this book, were there any sorts of issues in terms of changes or more?
No, I really loved what they did. They took the art that Shelley had done. They used a basic palette for the fonts and things, but they came up with a much better font.
Yeah.
They sort of positioned things, and I think it looks lovely. And I love the back. I think there's a... I think it's Drinking Coffee Elsewhere that when I saw the paperback of that, I thought, that is the most beautiful book design I've seen in a long time. And when Harcourt showed me the design for this, I was like, it's kind of like that. I love it.
Yeah.
A friend of mine yesterday was talking about the font on the back. She said it's sort of like the EC horror comic font where the, you know, and then it was real to him that, you know, the ghost was standing behind him in the hallway.
I would really love to see more of that kind of font, you know, return to these book covers.
Yeah. Have you read Shelley Jackson's Half-Life?
I haven't, and
you should pick up Half-Life. They would send it to you. Blog.
Yeah, okay.
Half-Life is great.
Okay. I will check that out. I do promise, among the, you know.
It's a San Francisco book.
Okay. I will. Actually, I wanted to ask you about the Q&A format to the canon. That's actually similar to the more explicit one that is, I mean, there's not so explicit one in The Girl Detective, where you have almost a kind of dialogue within the actual narrative. Mm-hmm. And also, the stories, I think, in Magic for Beginners are not so stylistically based as the ones in the previous book. And I was wondering, have you moved past the point of experimentation where it's all in the details, or
no? But I did want to try other things. You know, I wanted to experiment a little bit. I wanted to write stories that were a little bit looser, a little bit bulkier in some ways, and stories which were not as tightly controlled. And when we were doing sort of read after read through the collection before we sent it off to the printer, I was thinking, you know, this collection is just not very good. It's not as good as Stranger Things Happen was. And I was really, really, I thought, this is just not good. But then I went and I actually sat down and I looked through Stranger Things Happen, and I thought, oh, these stories actually aren't that good. This is okay. You know, these stories were not as good as I remembered. It was very liberating to read older work and think, you know, oh, These actually are not that good. You know, I can do better. I can do more stuff. I don't. Maybe other authors have that experience where if you put something aside, it sort of becomes crystallized in some odd way.
Yeah.
And when you take another look at it, you sort of. It's changed from this thing that it was in your head.
Yeah. No, I certainly know what I mean. Anything I wrote 4 years ago, I can't read. It's just terrible. Jesus, who is this? What do you do to kind of keep the level of invention going, or you know, the level of development you have developing? Maybe you could talk about this. I mean, do you really feel that it's all the same, or is this really a fair criticism to attach to yourself? Because like all writers have like certain themes they hover around or they constantly sort of explore, and I think it's almost endemic for.
Sure. No, I'm actually comfortable with the hovering around a certain set of themes. I figure you're just doomed in that respect. But it seemed to me that I was writing about the same kind of character frequently, and even things like sentence rhythm was I'd found a rhythm that was very comfortable to write in, and I was really using it not as a crutch, but that rhythm inevitably led to a similar kind of story. And so things like Catskin and the canon in this are an attempt to sort of do something that's not in my natural speaking voice.
Yeah.
Same with Stone Animals. You know, these are attempts to pick up a couple of new tricks, to write it to the different speeds or different rhythms, and to do stuff that does not feel so closely connected to the ways that I've learned how to tell stories.
Yeah, well, we were describing earlier how these were written, obviously, 2 days versus 1 year. There's a totally different rhythm you're going to...
Catskin was very fast. Catskin was a fast one. The canon was a pleasurably fast story to write. Again, that came out of that McSweeney's 20-minute exercise. Very grateful to McSweeney's, even though they left the stories out of the book.
Again, we're going to have to go charge down there with pitchforks. I wanted to ask you about, the canon. I kind of now get an idea of why it hadn't appeared. The canon and the zombie contingent plans didn't appear in anyone else. Were you saving these stories for this collection, or was there an effort to shop these around? Or?
No, I wanted to have some new work in the book.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was still tinkering with some zombie contingency plans, not up until the point that we published it, but also before putting it out in the paperback.
Yeah.
I like certain things I did in the story, but I also feel as if I didn't quite achieve what I was hoping for. I feel that way about Stone Animals, too. You know, there's certain stories that you finish and you think, I'm done. I'm done with that. And other stories you think, I'm not sure what I was trying to do, but I didn't quite do it.
Perception's terrible, isn't it?
Although I do love the fact that you know, when they x-ray paintings and when they clean them, they discover that the sort of process by which the painting has evolved,
yeah,
you know, sometimes over decades.
That would be a really sort of helpful thing for, you know, if you could release stories perhaps in Word files that sort of reflected the changes, like different versions or something.
I once sat down, you know, you can press the sort of key function that will
track changes.
Yeah. And that's beautiful to watch. It's hypnotic.
Yeah.
And great, like certain pages will just change and change and change and change, and other things stay relatively the same.
I wanted to ask you about Lady Churchill's and how editing has perhaps helped you as a writer. Has looking at other people's stories and giving them advice on how to sort of, you know, massage them or improve them really sort of helped you kind of...
I'm uncomfortable with the term massage used in context of story.
No, okay. I don't know where that came from. Maybe
I've heard it used before. I've heard it used before.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm teasing you. I just picture the instructor sort of massaging the page and the student sort of sitting and thinking,
well,
ew.
It would certainly make the MFA workshops a lot more interesting.
It would.
Yeah. But anyway, but no, massaging or not,
sure,
or, you know, whatever verb, choose your verb of choice. Sure. Has this helped you sort of from a perception standpoint as a writer? Or?
Yeah, I think that both teaching and also in peer workshops. You know, this is not a thought original to me by any means, as most of these thoughts are not.
Yeah.
But the thing that teaches you the most about writing is not the feedback that you get from other people on your work, but rather looking closely at other people's work and seeing how other people write and figuring out what it was that they were trying to do and seeing ways in which, you know, that could be done for greater effect or... When I teach at a science fiction workshop in the summer, Clarion.
Yeah.
I taught last semester in North Carolina. I do a fair amount of teaching and workshops, and I'm a meddler. But you need, if you're a writer, it's helpful actually to have at least one instructor who goes through and line edits your manuscript and shows you, you know, what things can be stripped out of stories. And so when I read, I'm thinking about what the writer is trying to do, but I'm also thinking about what things can come out, and when those things are taken out, is the story improved? Does the story change in interesting ways? You know, there are all sorts of tricks that you learn. You learn that when you look at the end of a paragraph, if you're a newer writer, frequently the paragraph has gone on for a sentence too long or two sentences too long. And so you look and you see, did you end at the right place or did you keep on going? And the same thing with endings. You know, did you go on a paragraph too long, two paragraphs too long? When you began, can you cut out the first two pages and where you were sort of figuring out what the story was about? Are you explaining your character's motivations? You know, does the character say something and the writer explains to the reader how the reader is supposed to see what the character has just said? And so when you're teaching, it's useful to sort of bracket those or take them out so that the writer can see, you know, maybe these things are not necessary. Maybe. And so what I always say is if I've marked up your paragraphs a lot here, what I really want you to do is just go and take a really close look at them and see what you think. See if any of this can go. because you can frequently take a story that has too much stuff and just strip stuff out. In fact, the story is really quite good. Sorry. We're retrieving a sandwich.
I'm so sorry that the sandwich has languished there. I apologize.
Okay. It's a beautiful sandwich.
It is a beautiful sandwich, and thankfully it's not going anywhere. Well, there's one other question I wanted to ask you so I can allow you to eat your sandwich. This will be the last one. George Saunders was recently awarded...
He got the MacArthur. Which is fantastic.
It is fantastic, but here's the thing that just doesn't get me. It's like... The level of invention, the level of fantasy in his work, I would argue, is just as equal to the level of fantasy in your work. What do you think accounts for him to sort of get that kind of, you know, New Yorker sort of stature, or the MacArthur stature, and then you to sort of be pigeonholed into this whole fantasy thing? Because, like, The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, for example, it's just as crazed and magical a world as, like, you know, it's the one that's in Magic for Beginners, you know?
I love George Saunders' work,
and
he's been writing for a much longer time, but not much longer. You know, he's not ancient, but he's produced a lot of work. He's also taught for a long time, and you know, I feel as if the MacArthur probably goes to people who have contributed in some way.
Yeah.
You know, not just with their work, the literary work, but maybe also by how they sort of. By the work they do in the community. And I can't tell you why certain stories end up in the New Yorker, but have you read Ben Rice? He had a short...
Poppy and Dingin. I loved that little, you know...
It's a fabulous book. Yeah. And he had one story in the New Yorker. And again, this is the same vein as George Saunders and Amy Bender and Judy Budnitz and Stacey Richter and, you know, all the people who do this kind of stuff. But it's weird stuff. And so what I feel is I feel really happy that this work is popping up in unexpected places. It seems like a hopeful thing. For one thing, it means that I really like the stuff coming out of the New Yorker. The last year, I'm not as caught up as I should be in either the fiction or the nonfiction, but there were a couple of years that were pretty stellar in terms of short stories.
Well, it also helps. I mean, they seem to be expanding their definition of literary fiction. I mean, like Stephen King in recent years has appeared in there. I mean, you know, I guess, though, I mean, it still speaks to this troubling discrepancy. You use literary fiction as a pejorative, and I would argue that, well, on this matter, I have to say, hey, wait a sec, you know, why don't we just broaden the net, and that way it doesn't become this kind of stingy term. I mean, you know, because George Saunders, one might argue, was a fantasy writer, or possibly in that science fiction writing mode that we're talking about.
You could call
it
fiction-y literature.
Okay, fictiony literature. I like that. It's like truthiness.
Literary, yeah. just there's a quality to literary fiction, which wow. sort of a duplicating thing there.
Wow.
It's not just fiction. It's literary fiction.
Actually,
it's not just
if fiction, all fiction is literary, isn't this an oxymoron, maybe?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, maybe I'm catching on.
Fictiony literature.
I will use greater
use
care.
Use it.
All right, well, I'm going to let you eat your sandwich.
Oh, thank
Kelly, thank you so much.
It's great to talk to you.